Welcome to Rediscovering Earth's Lost Topography Podcast. Today, we're here at World Bird Sanctuary with Roger Holloway as our guest. I would like to welcome you, Roger, to our show. Thanks for being here, Roger.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thanks so much for having us.
Yeah, so let's talk about the history behind World Bird Sanctuary. Did it actually start here, and how long ago did World Bird Sanctuary start?
World Bird Sanctuary actually started at the home of Walter C. Crawford Jr. He worked at the St. Louis Zoo at the time. At that point in the mid-70s, kind of by default, if people found injured birds and birds of prey specifically, they'd bring them to the zoo and they'd end up with Walter, who worked in the bird department at the zoo. And the zoo wasn't interested in rehabilitating birds and wildlife, so he took the birds home and rehabilitated them in his basement and his backyard. And eventually he got space at the Tyson Research Center, which is still today run by Washington University. And that's where he started a rehabilitation center full-time as a nonprofit. And then eventually it moved where we are today in Valley Park. And it expanded from being a rehab center into an education facility and a breeding center as well.
Okay. And you guys get birds from obviously all over the world, correct? Do you have birds that are brought into you from all over the world? Or do you just get birds
primarily? In terms of our conservation efforts, we are have partnerships where we would get birds from other parts of the world for breeding and conservation. As far as our hospital goes, the birds we get are mostly local to the St. Louis area or the eastern part of Missouri and Illinois. Sometimes they might come from a little further away, but there's a large network of wildlife rehabilitators around the country. So we don't want to have injured birds traveling real far, because it's stressful enough when they're injured, much less having to travel a great distance to get care.
Okay. What are the most common birds that you guys see here?
The most common birds in our hospital are red-tailed hawks and red-shouldered hawks. We get a lot of Cooper's hawks, great-horned and barred owls. We do see bald eagles every so often. Kira, what other birds besides those?
So those are definitely the big ones, with barred owls being the largest. Barred owls make up nearly 30% of our total patients each year. We also get a decent number of American kestrels and a growing number of Mississippi kites. Okay. And then we'll have a few single species that are kind of more rare occurrences, such as eastern screech owls, long-eared owls, snowy owls, goshawks, sharp-shinned hawks.
What's the most common things that you see them for?
Our most common injury is going to be collision with a vehicle or hit by a vehicle. We also get quite a few window strikes. Then we get an assortment of entanglement injuries. That's going to be soccer nets, barbed wire, fishing line as our most common. We get gunshot injuries. We get lead poisoning. A lot of ours just come in with an unknown cause, because they're found injured in someone's backyard and you don't really have a way of asking the bird, well, what happened to you? How did you get injured? So you know that they have a broken wing, but you don't really know how they got it. This time of year, it is the spring, so it is baby season. So another one we see is just a lot of fell from nest or nest destroyed. So these are a lot, these spring storms with these high winds and tornadoes that come through. The birds are at a very kind of vulnerable time in their lives where they're still in the nest, and they can fairly easily blow out or have those entire trees come down where they end up on the ground and injured from that.
I did see something about that on YouTube, actually, with the baby eaglet by Murphy, is that correct?
Yeah, Murphy is one of our permanent resident bald eagles who we've had now for 32 years. And he fostered a baby eagle that came into the hospital having, like Kira said, fallen from its nest when the nest was damaged in a storm.
Okay. The thing that I seen during that video, which that baby eaglet had a big pouch.
Yes.
Maybe you call that on a bird.
So that's called the crop, and it's essentially a very stretchy organ attached to their esophagus. So as they eat food will go into that first, and this allows them to eat a large amount at one time from one meal and store it there, and then throughout the day they'll move pieces from the crop actually through their digestive system, so they can kind of eat a bunch all at once and then have nutrition and calories for the entire day. So hawks and eagles have a crop. Owls actually do not have a crop, but they do still have a very stretchy esophagus, so they can still hold some extra in there, but it does form just like this big lump right in front of the chest, and when they've had a big meal you can see it just sitting there.
Oh wow. So basically I guess you guys get calls then, is that correct, whenever you have a rescue that you have to go out to get the birds? Do people just call the number here?
Yep. So our hospital has a separate line from our office, and people can call that directly to get a hold of someone at our hospital. We do now have that as a cell phone, which has been a huge change for rehabilitators in helping us better assess the situation and making sure that birds that don't need to come in don't come in. So when they call us, we're going to ask them what the bird's doing, what the behavior is, and then we're also going to ask them to text us a photo of the bird. And this is going to let us do that kind of visual assessment. We can look for symmetry in the wings, see if one's drooping, see if there's blood on the bird, see if they look kind of depressed. So there's a change in body posture that you can see from a healthy bird to a depressed bird. So you can look at that in these photos and go, yes, this bird looks like it's something that needs help, or no, you have a healthy fledgling there, because this time of year, those fledglings that are just leaving the nest, it's normal for them to spend time on the ground, and that does not mean that they need to come to our hospital. So that's going to be the first thing, is looking at those photos, and then if we do decide they need to come in, we're going to ask the finder if they're willing to contain the bird, if we talk them through how to do it, and about 40% of finders are actually willing to catch the bird and contain it, put it in a box, and then possibly bring it to us. If they're not willing to do that, we then contact our rescue group, send someone out there to contain the bird and bring it to us. And we will occasionally get birds that, once they get here, we find, okay, you were actually healthy, you're just acting a little weird, but you're fine. And so we'll have our rescuer take them back right away as well to reunite them with their parents.
Okay, so you bring them back to the same place that you picked them up from.
Yes, we do.
Okay, that's fantastic. And basically, how do you guys get funding for this? And also, is that phone number that you have, is that something that you want public, or is that something that you want that you guys keep private? Or do you have, like, the World Sanctuary? Do you have a phone number that people call? Or how do people get in touch with you if they do find an injured bird that needs rescue?
So, yeah, we have that hospital line on us open from 8 a.m. to 7 p.m. every day. Someone will be answering that phone. They'll get directly to a person, as long as we're not already on the phone, in which case they can leave us a message. We'll give them a call back. They can also text us if they prefer. And we're happy to have the public have that number. We actually have it on a little rescue info card that we hand out when we're interacting with the public, so they can have our number as well as the number of the other local rehabilitators. So if you're in St. Louis area and have an injured bird,
of prey, yes.
Our hospital number is 314-337 8889. Now, if you have an injured bird or other wildlife and you're from outside the St. Louis area, there is likely a rehabber near you that can help you out. And there is a website you can go to actually find your nearest rehabilitator. And that's the Animal Help Now website. So that's www.ahnow.org. And you can go in there, type in your zip code, and then click Wildlife Emergency. And it's going to pull up rehabilitators by zip code closest to you. And it's going to list what species they take. So our hospital will pop up on there. It's only going to be rehabbers that have registered through that website, but it is a pretty comprehensive list. There's a lot of rehabbers on there, so pretty much anyone can find help. So when we get calls from out of state, which we do, we direct them to that website. We even, on rare occasions, get international calls, which has been a little trickier. Yesterday, we actually took a call from South Korea looking for help with a falcon that they found. We did a quick Google search and found them some local resources to help them get that that bird to someone.
That'd be a long trip. Do you have volunteers that go out to assist with getting the birds? Or
yes, we do. We have a network of volunteers that just help us with transport. So we have about 100 people in that group now, and they live in St. Louis and the surrounding areas. So our goal is to build up that transporter group so that we have someone close by whenever a bird's injured, because sometimes getting them here quickly is going to be critical in actually giving them a chance at getting better. So if we have someone who's already near the bird when the call comes in, the fastest way to get them here is to have that person drive them straight here. Some of these birds are coming from up to usually 3 hours away is about kind of our max before you start getting to a closer rehabber. So we don't want to send someone 3 hours from here up to there, then another 3 hours back, because that's 6 hours before that bird gets some help. So if we can cut that in half, that's great. But
and you give specific directions on how to transport the bird and all that kind of stuff, because bird of preys are, they're obviously all protected, correct?
They are.
So how does somebody transport a bird without injuring a bird further, or taking any risk for the person transporting the bird.
So most states are going to have what's called Good Samaritan laws, which protect people who are transporting wildlife with the intention of getting it help. So that's always one concern people have is, am I going to get in trouble for picking this up? And if you're taking it to get help, you're not going to get in trouble for picking it up. But with most injured wildlife, if they are injured enough for you to notice that they're injured, they're going to try and hide that injury as long as possible. So even a very sick hawk may still be up in a tree trying to look normal for as long as possible, because as soon as they look injured on the ground, then they're food for other things. So once they're on the ground and people have noticed them, they don't really have too much energy left in them. So people are often surprised at how easy it was to pick up an injured bird. But what we have them do is take like a thick towel or blanket or something, other thick form of fabric to throw over the bird's head. These guys are very visually oriented, so when you cover their head, they do tend to freeze up. And then you can kind of scoop their wings into either side, pick them up like a big football, and place them into a box or pet carrier or whatever other enclosed item you have. If people have leather welding gloves, that's always advisable to put on as an extra layer of protection, but they usually do just stand there and let you pick them up and put them in there. And then it's going to be important for people to reduce stress on the animal. So handling it a bunch is going to increase stress. Having kids look at it, a bunch of talking, loud noises is all going to stress out the bird. So then kind of placing that box in a quiet, dark place and minimizing visual and auditory stimuli is really going to help reduce the stress level of that animal until you can get it some help.
Okay.
Yeah, so they're not going to want to be near people. So it's really that injury or illness that's going to prevent them from getting away or trying to get away when they just don't have the strength or energy left. But if you can pick up an adult bird, there's something wrong with it. You should never be able to pick up a healthy adult bird. It will not let you get that close.
Okay. So how do you guys get your volunteers?
So my name's Eileen Abbott. I'm the Director of Community Engagement, and I also head up our volunteer program. And we have volunteer opportunities listed on our website, but honestly, word of mouth has been a great promoter for this program, as well as just talking to people who visit. People who come here for the first time will often fall in love with the place and come back and then want to do more and more, and they become volunteers. So we have volunteer opportunities in all the different areas that we have here at World Bird Sanctuary. So in the rehab hospital, besides our rescue volunteers, you can also volunteer to help out in the hospital. You can volunteer to help out at our education training center, on our Avian Avenue, which is our public area, and in the nature center where we do programs as well as care for our birds. We have close to 200 permanent resident birds, and they need to be taken care of every day, every single day. And those volunteers are critical to what we do because we only have so many staff to fill these needs. So we appreciate volunteers, and we throw them in there and teach them how to do cleaning and food prep and proper laundry and, you know, show them how to care for these amazing birds.
How long does your training normally go for a volunteer?
It all depends on the particular area. There's an application process, and then they are assigned a certain area. And then that new volunteer will work directly with that area manager, and they'll set up a first day and kind of go through that orientation and give a little tour. And then it's going to be probably a few shifts, and a few shifts could be 4 hours, so a half day, or 8 hours, a full day. And you're going to need multiple shifts in order to become what we would consider fully trained. And we encourage volunteers to be consistent when they come in, because there's always going to be changes. There's always going to be updates. So the more frequently they can come in, the more they will stay on all of the changes and updates. But as we are a 7-day-a-week facility, they have multiple options to come in 7 days.
Okay. And do you guys, how many volunteers do you guys have?
We currently have a little over 200 active volunteers. So Nice. We have adult volunteers, which is anyone 18 and above. We also have a junior volunteer program, which starts at age 14 and goes to 17.
So with the juniors and stuff like that, does that give them the opportunity, like down the road, to maybe get a degree or do something more as a professional vet or anything like that?
Absolutely. This is, we have several examples of adults now who started off as junior volunteers who are in the field. We have several examples of volunteers that just came here because they love the facility, they love birds, but ended up changing their majors to get into more of a zoology, wildlife biology. So it can absolutely be a life-changing program, but it's also a lot of fun and it's hard work. And what's great with the hard work is they can see the outcome of their hard work. Yep.
Yeah, that's the really cool half of it is any outdoors person that truly is an outdoors person, cares about nature and stuff like that, they want to see the positive. I mean, and when you can volunteer here and actually see birds that come in injured and then get released later on, to me, that's awesome. I mean, I was asking one of your staff earlier, the bird that got released, the eaglet.
Right.
So did Murphy get depressed or whatever after it raised that bird? And
that was a common question or comment, especially on the social media side of our of the story that we were sharing with everybody. But the birds of prey don't have that kind of, I don't even know if I want to use the word emotion, but that's not how they operate. In the wild, their chicks grow up within 3-4 months and they're gone. The parents don't feed them anymore. They have to go on out on their own. And it's the same thing here. In fact, if anything, it would be the opposite, because as bald eagle chicks grow, the bigger they get, the less polite they are.
Oh, really?
Well, meaning that in the nest, naturally, it gets very competitive. They don't want to share the food, and not everybody gets the same opportunity to eat. The parents don't always intervene if one's not getting enough food. It's not very nice sometimes. That's the reality of it. So as far as a situation in human care, the bigger this foster chick got, the less polite it was around Murphy, meaning that if the food was delivered into the aviary where they were, we did it on the sly, so the birds didn't know that it was coming from people, so there's no human contact. But you know, then that young chick got bigger and bigger, and he wanted that food first, and Murphy was just like, okay, you know, just wait his turn.
Wow.
So by the time the chick was big enough to be released, you know, Murphy was just ready to go back to his routine. There's no attachment there like people might think there was. It's a great foster story, and it's inspiring to us that an adult eagle would care for a young one that way that's not his own, beyond that initial relationship that they had where the young eagle just saw one of his own kind feeding him and therefore imprinted on it and stayed wild. That's as far as it goes. There's no more emotional or part of Murphy's life that, oh, I sure miss that baby. No, he doesn't miss his baby. It's not part of his life anymore.
Okay. Well, and you just brought up a point that I know I wanted to know. I know my wife wanted to know, because eagle cams, they're out there all over YouTube. I mean, sure. I don't know how people are doing it. I don't know how they get cams that close to the nest, but
you got to have a good tree climber.
I bet.
A trained and experienced tree climber.
Yeah. Well, the one thing I noticed, and that was huge, well, my wife noticed as well, is we seen an eagle cam with two baby eaglets in it. And it was exactly what you just mentioned. We were watching on a long-term basis, and we seen one eaglet that was very, very food hungry, and the other one was not getting the food that we thought that it needed. Mm-hmm. Obviously it did. It grew up. It was the last one out of the nest, but it was amazing, because I didn't even think about that. The fact that, you know, it doesn't look like they like sharing. They don't want to give food up. If the food's coming in,
that's right,
the first one that gets it. And it's almost like, I don't know if the parents were specifically going to that Pacific Eagle or if they knew that the other one was full enough. I have no clue, but I don't know what goes through their heads when when they're feeding their babies, but it is an amazing thing. I like watching the Eagle cams, the Falcon cams, and stuff like that. Those are just awesome to me. So
yeah, most raptor species are going to have a breeding technique that's kind of a staggered incubation period. So they'll lay the first egg and start incubating, and then they'll lay the next one either the next day or 2 days later and continue incubating. But the incubation period remains the same for them. So the first egg laid is often the first egg hatched. And that extra day or two of age, because of how fast young raptors grow, can really make a size difference for these individuals. And so when the parents bring food to the nest, whoever is pushiest and most obnoxious is going to get fed first by the parents. If you're up front and you have your face in mom's face as she's trying to feed you, you're going to be the one getting fed. So what tends to happen is the pushiest one will get fed until they're full, and then they'll kind of back off because they kind of eat their fill and then go to sleep. And then whoever's next pushiest gets fed next. And then if there's still food left, then maybe if there's a third one, they'll also get fed. But what tends to happen if the parents are not finding enough food, this is another of those harsh realities of nature, usually the same baby is not going to get fed every time. And that one, as it gets weaker, is going to be less pushy and therefore is still going to be the last one fed. But it kind of ensures like maximum survival rate. So rather than having three babies that all didn't quite get enough food, you have two that got enough food and did well and one that perished, essentially. But this is going to be kind of part of most raptor breeding techniques, and it's part of in the hospital when we get a lot of patient babies in, we'll house them together, and essentially as long as there's enough food, everyone's getting along, and we'll weigh all those babies regularly to make sure that all of our babies are getting enough food, because no one's going to die of starvation in a rehab hospital.
Right. Now, do you guys feed them mice, or what do you feed the babies?
Mice and rats are one of our preferred food items. For the babies, they need kind of extra high nutrition because they are growing so quickly. So they need a lot of calcium to deposit all those bones that are growing. They also need all the micronutrients for growing in strong, healthy feathers and putting on all that weight. So mice and rats are one of like the best like whole food items we get. So they can eat the small organ meat. They can eat all the different muscle tissue. They can eat the bones and digest them. But we do also use other food items here. We get donated venison, either from hunters who are cleaning out their freezer for the next year. Missouri Department of Transportation will bring us fresh roadkill deer that they find, and we'll use the usable parts from that. We will use like the day-old chicks, which are the males from the egg-laying industry. We also get donated wild prey from some local falconers, so that's going to be like local rabbits and squirrels that we get. We're also going to use rabbit from breeders and trout.
Okay. And I'm like, for the babies, I guess you have to either liquefy that or something, or do they actually chew it themselves?
So they can swallow pretty large pieces. So we're going to chop it into pieces small enough for them to eat depending on their size. So the smaller and younger the baby, the smaller we have to chop it. But starting at a pretty young age, they can eat like whole mice, and they'll just kind of swallow them down. They can just adjust them so their mouth opens quite wide, and that throat and that we were talking about, that stretchy esophagus with the crop, just kind of stretches to allow food to go down there. So
wow. So jumping from that topic, we're gonna bring up one thing about the nests, and we were talking about like the eagles and the nests and stuff like that, but like, are bald eagles, do they have the biggest nests? Are they one of the biggest nests out there? Or
as far as birds of prey go, absolutely. Because they, when things go well for a given breeding pair, they'll mate for life and try to use the same nest and nesting territory year after year. So they add to the nest each time they come back. They replenish it and they fill it with new lining, and that usually being pine tree branches that help as kind of a natural insecticide, coniferous trees. So yeah, they keep adding to it. And if a bald eagle in the wild, it might live 20 or 25 years, would be a good life. And if they get 20 years as a nesting pair, that nest is going to get really big until sometimes the tree falls over because it's so much extra weight.
So they get that big enough to drop a tree.
Yep.
Wow. So how many feet across does an average bald eagle?
One of the statistics I recall is 9 feet across.
Holy cow. That's big.
It is.
That is really big.
Measure out 9 feet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're sitting at a table that's 6 foot. Mm-hmm. So you add another 3 foot onto that. That's a big nest.
Yeah.
So, but other birds of prey, are their nests anywhere close to that size or?
Not that I'm aware of.
I mean,
you can, we get good since we're bird watchers and bird geeks, we like to call ourselves. So we might identify where a hawk nest is. And your everyday person that's not in tune to that might not notice it, but it's big enough that we'll see it. And we'll try to, monitor the activity there. If it's one that's on the roadside, on the way to work, in a tree or whatever. But yeah, they can get pretty big too. So you can, with binoculars, spot it and look at it, but not to the size of a bald eagle nest.
Okay.
And different species definitely have different nest building skill capabilities. So,
and motivation.
And motivation. So most owl species don't actually build any form of nest. So barred owls will use like a tree hollow. Great horned owls will use a tree hollow or steal someone else's nest. So great horned owls are one of the first species to nest each year. So they arrive back on the breeding territories first. And they'll just steal someone else's nest from last year. So this may be a red-tailed hawk nest. This may be a barred owl's tree cavity. There have even been documented cases of great horned owls stealing bald eagle nests, moving in and going, "This looks big enough. I think I'll take this one. This one's nice."
Wow.
But they'll take essentially whatever they find and use that as their nest because they're first there and one of the most aggressive. And then you have some that don't even bother nesting in a tree, like snowy owls or ground nesters. They'll make just kind of a depression around there. So most of the hawks build a few more nests, but there's, again, a skill range there. We do notice in rehab that we tend to see more young red-shouldered hawk babies that fell out of the nest than we do red-tailed babies. And we attribute some of this to the fact that red-tailed hawks tend to build a better nest. They build one a little bit bigger, it's got a little bit deeper of a bowl, and they don't tend to have too many babies for the nest size, versus sometimes we get these red-shoulder nests that a baby falls out every other day because it's too small. So we've put up surrogate nests in some of these cases where we can put a bigger one that's actually big enough for us to put all the babies back in with the parents because there just wasn't room in the original nest because it was too small for how many babies they had.
So you actually have somebody go up into the tree and actually put a nest up there for...
Yep, we have a tree trimming company that's volunteered their services for us. And they are certified tree climbers, so they'll go up there. So we'll send out either one of our staff members or a volunteer to meet them. We'll bring a nest that we've constructed, which is woven of sticks, to try and look as natural as possible. We used to use laundry baskets, but it's a little harder to convince a homeowner to let you put a laundry basket in their tree. So the woven stick nest look a lot more natural. So we'll send them to meet the tree climbers with the stick nest and the healthy baby that's ready to be returned. And they'll climb up the tree. Then they'll lower a rope down, we'll attach it to the nest, they'll hoist it up there, secure it in a good spot using either like zip ties or twine or kind of like a sisal rope or something that will break down. And then they'll put the babies back into that nest that we've added up there and the parents will come back and be able to continue raising it. So it's our way of keeping these healthy babies with their wild families even when the nest isn't suitable for us to return it to.
That's really cool. And when you think about owls, you think about, well, I think about the country or places where barns are at and stuff like that. But the thing that's wild to us is we are huge bird feeders. We love feeding birds of all kinds. We did not realize, since we've been feeding birds for probably about 7 years, maybe 8 years now, that we would eventually have Cooper hawks, which are, we're in a subdivision. I have no clue where these Cooper hawks are staying, but...
That's their goal for you to know.
That's right. they do a good job of it.
Very good.
But I will tell you what, they are very, very, very fast because we have our carport, then we have our bird feeding station out there so we can sit on our carport underneath the roof and look out there at the feeding station. And we'll be watching, and a squirrel will be sitting there on the bottom brick eating bird food that's falling out of the feeder or whatever. And just the other day, that Cooper hawk just swooped down real fast, grabbed it, and went, phew, and it was gone. I mean, there was no, nothing. I mean, it was history. So I don't even know where it went to. It just took off and went straight back up. But
well, if it was recently, then it's...
It was recent.
Got young somewhere, and it's got a lot of mouths to feed.
Okay. Well, and then the other thing that we have in our neighborhood is an owl, but we do not know where the owls stay. And we do know it's there. We've not actually placed eyes on it, but you can definitely hear the noise. I'm not going to mimic what it sounds like. But
we can.
Go ahead.
Okay. It could be a great horned owl. Do you want to do one, Eileen?
No, Roger, this is all you.
Okay. If it was the barred owl, you'll hear, ooh, 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 ooh. Like that, a little bit higher pitch, has a little trill on the end. The great horned owl will be deeper. It's like, I'm a little dry in my throat, but that monotone deeper hoot would be the great horned owl.
Well, between those two, I mean, it definitely sounded pretty close. So, I mean, at first, I thought it was... like, I was telling my son, maybe it's pigeons or doves or whatever, because they got that.
Well, yeah, morning dove will have what sounds to some people like an owl.
Yeah, but it's definitely not that, because morning doves are not out way in the middle of the night, I don't think.
not that I've heard.
But we take our dog out in the middle of the night, and you can hear that owl. And we have a chocolate lab, and it's... crazy, because we can't see it. It's just black back there, but it's funny how our chocolate lab will actually just cut.
Well, instinct's kicking in there. It knows. Yep. It's a predator out
he
there.
He knows that something's up there, but he doesn't know where it's at, right. Neither do we. So, and we also have hummingbirds, which goes, we're going from the hugest nest to probably the tiniest nest. Do hummingbirds actually... do they live in houses or do they just live in little nests?
They make their own little cup nest.
About the size of an acorn cap, right? Or a little bit bigger?
It's a bit bigger than that, and they'll decorate it with lichens. They make amazing little nests. They're just like engineered perfectly.
But okay.
Certainly one of the smaller nests.
And they don't stay year-round, right?
Or no, they're a migratory bird. They have to go to Central and South America for the winter.
Okay. Well... they got fast wings. They can fly fast.
It's a long trip for a little bird that, you know, weighs 15 grams.
Holy cow. Yeah, it's amazing. How many eggs do they actually have, hummingbirds? And I know we're getting away from bird of prey, but...
that's okay. I don't know, three or four?
Two or three, yeah.
In the nest, that tiny?
Yeah, as far as I know.
How big are their eggs?
Well, it's going to be smaller than a jelly bean.
Yeah.
Is what I would guess.
It's also going to vary on species because there is still a range of sizes amongst the hummingbirds. So the smaller the bird, the smaller the egg.
Yeah, the smallest one is the bee hummingbird that weighs 3 grams. 3 grams. That's a tenth of an ounce.
Yeah. That's tiny.
Yeah.
And it's amazing because, I mean, we got, I think, what, 4 hummingbird feeders out there. And the amazing thing is they sound, you just said bee, but that's basically when you're sitting out there and they fly past you, you may not see them, but it sounds like a bumblebee is what.
Yeah, they live up to their name for sure with how fast the wings are beating. But, yeah, like Kira said, if you go to, here we have the ruby-throated hummingbird at our feeders that we love to see every year. And if you go to Central America and South America, you know, you can see, I don't know.
So many.
80 species of hummingbirds in something the size of this room.
Wow.
Because they're so diverse. And they can be much bigger than what we see here, too. Not all hummingbirds are tiny.
That's amazing. So As far as, like, again, volunteers, what do they have to do?
Our biggest need for volunteers, honestly, is just to have people ready to make a commitment to come in and help us out. The more frequently volunteers can come and stay up to date and help their areas out, the more they help us achieve our mission goals. They help take care of the birds, and they really make this facility. They really help make this facility run, and we couldn't do many things without them. So it's filling out an application. There's a couple of, you know, contact forms. We do ask that volunteers are current on a tetanus booster, because working with birds of prey, you obviously need to be careful. We're working with wire around the aviaries and cleaning, and sometimes even construction. So we want to make sure they stay safe. So it's having that passion and willingness to work. Mm-hmm. And that's what we're looking for.
Yeah, your volunteer experience, the more you put in, the more you're essentially going to get out of it. I am one who started as a volunteer, not at World Bird Sanctuary, but at another raptor rehabilitation organization in Colorado. And my goal was to eventually make this my career. So I was there twice a week, doing whatever they needed and asking as many questions as I could to learn every aspect about both rehabilitation and education. And then decided that I wanted to go down the rehabilitation path as opposed to the education one for my career. But a lot of our staff started that way. Almost all of our staff are going to have started as either a volunteer or an intern somewhere. And we have people here who, volunteers here, who come in once or twice a week. They're here all the time. They get to learn a lot as part of their volunteer experience, because when you come in every week, you're remembering the things from the previous week, so you don't have to kind of do a refresher of those. And that means that we can teach you something new. And there's always something new here to learn. So what people learn really comes down to how much they want to learn out of it, how many skills they want to learn, how many questions they ask to get information. And all of us here can continue to talk about birds all day if you let us. We'll just keep talking about birds, and we'll talk about rehab, we'll talk about education, we'll talk about avian training. We'll just keep going. So if you have volunteers and you want to learn a lot from a volunteer experience, ask those questions to find out what you want to know.
That brings up a few other questions. How old does someone have to be to volunteer out here, and what kind of training do they get?
Our junior volunteers start at age 14 and goes to 17, and then adult volunteers are 18 and up. And the training is just dependent upon which area. Your training is your day one. So the first time you come in to volunteer, you start your training, and it depends, the length of time depends on how quickly you pick up, how thorough you are, the quality of your work. So the better you do, the shorter your official training time starts. And then, as Kira was saying, the more opportunities you'll have for learning new ways to help us out.
Yeah, and also you mentioned that you knew you wanted to do this for a long time. Would you consider yourselves to be birders? I realize you kind of work in the field, but, you know, I'm a Missouri Master Naturalist, and we hang around with some people who keep lists, and they travel all over the world to look for this rare bird.
So I am in the minority in this field, in that I am not a birder. All of my love for birds is in raptors. I mean, I love all birds, but my, like, real focus and passion is for raptors and is for rehabilitation. And while I enjoy seeing birds out in the wild when I'm out doing hiking or whatever outdoor activities I might enjoy, I do not actively make a list and go out and bird, but I know a lot of the staff here do.
Mm-hmm. I've been to Costa Rica for birds. I love birding, but I've also been in the outdoor education field for over 30 years. So I kind of love everything in nature, but certainly being here has reinvigorated the focus on our feathered friends that are all over the world. So I am a birder. I love birds. I would consider myself very basic and novice, because I'm not quite there yet to get too in depth.
Yeah, I'm also similar to Eileen as far as I would consider myself a birder. If I go to especially another part of the country, or if I'm lucky enough to go to another country, I'll be constantly birding. And like Eileen mentioned, Costa Rica is such a biologically diverse place. You're never not birding there. whether you're having coffee in the morning outside at a cafe or whatever, you're always birding in a place like that. So that's kind of what let me know within myself that, yeah, I'm a birder. If I don't want to do anything else, or if I'm okay just doing that, you know, you want to go whitewater rafting? No, 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 I'm just going to sit here and bird. I'm good with that, you know. That's when you know you're a birder, when you're willing to forego maybe some other exciting things, because I'm still, after years ago going to Costa Rica, still going through and looking at my notes and going back to the field guide to make sure I have my list complete with all the species I saw, because there were just so many.
Yeah. You know, earlier you were talking about hummingbirds, and I was bicycling through Belize a few years ago down the Hummingbird Highway, and I saw those flocks. It was really overwhelming. So I know you said you like raptors, but what are your favorite birds? Is there like that one species, you know, I like eagles and not so much owls or anything like that? What birds really you have a relationship with?
Yeah, being immersed with birds of prey here, the sanctuary started as the Raptor Rehabilitation and Propagation Project to show how much it encompasses the work and that it worked with birds of prey. I think we probably all have our favorite songbird that we bird for, but the birds of prey, I have to say that the barn owl is, if I have to choose a favorite, because all the owls in the world are divided into two families in taxonomy. The barn owl is its own family of all those because of how unique it is just being an owl. And because with being the predator that they are of such an immeasurable benefit to mankind, because 95% or thereabouts is of their diet is rodents that damage our property and damage our food supply. And they're the pinnacle of what a natural control is. And when we screw up life for them, it's not long after that we have problems surviving. So that's been part of our conservation message about preserving these kinds of birds. But from having the privilege of working with them in education, barn owls are just so unique and so amazing and really help to us to share the message about their benefits and they get people's attention. You know, they get the attention of the school kids that we share them with because it's such a unique looking bird and it does so many amazing things as a predator. So that's my favorite.
Eileen, do you have a special one?
I do.
And we won't let the birds listen to this podcast because we're not supposed to have favorites. So
I grew up in upstate New York in the 80s, and it was the DDT time, and I was just so frightened that I would never see a bald eagle in the wild. And every once in a while, I just think of me being here now in 2024. I see bald eagles every day. I've had them on my arm. I've flown a bald eagle. It's truly a dream come true, because of that early childhood fear. So they will always have a special place.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. I mean, a lot of people might have trouble believing this, but just a few years ago, bald eagles were almost extinct. You know, I was a kid, we never saw them. And now I do a lot of kayaking. Every time I go out there, I get to see one.
Yeah, it's a
conservation
success story.
So that's one of our great success stories, yeah. What about you? Do you have a favorite?
You know, my favorite is probably one of the most basic and widespread species. I really love red-tailed hawks. I love seeing them everywhere. I love driving down the highway and seeing them up on the signpost. But they were also one of the first birds that really got me into raptors. So I grew up reading the Animorphs books, and that was my introduction to wildlife rehab and to raptors. And that is actually what got me interested in this career originally. And red-tailed hawks are featured prominently in that. So that's always been a species of interest for me, and I still love them now. I also am very fond of broad-winged hawks, which I've only gotten to work with a few. They're one of the rarer birds through our hospital. But you basically took all of the attitude of a red tail and compacted it into something about a fifth the size. They are only about 12 inches tall. They weigh about 300 to 400 grams. and they have all the big attitude of a much bigger bird. And I really like that about them. And the fact that they make that long migration is, I think, very impressive as
well.
So
they're kind of like the chihuahuas of the bird world.
A little bit. They're both very resilient species, for sure. Yeah.
Okay, so other end of the spectrum, are there any birds you just say, well, you know, me and that bird, we just don't get along? Some birds might be a little crankier than some of the other birds.
I wouldn't say crankier. I would say one of my least favorite ones to work with in a rehab hospital are osprey, and that's more a product of how high stress they are. So they are very high strung, very prone to self-injury. They don't tend to like to eat, so they're very difficult to work with. And so that just always makes it a very kind of stressful situation, because you're really trying to get the bird better, but everything you do with them causes them so much stress. So they're one that's really harder to work with, and they smell strongly of fish. So the whole hospital smells like fish on the rare occasions we have an osprey in here. And they're not very common in the St. Louis and the surrounding areas. So we don't get very many, but that's probably one of my least favorite ones to work with in a rehab setting.
What's the most common question kids ask you when they come out here?
How old are the birds?
Mm-hmm.
When were they hatched?
Can I touch it?
So as far as age, I mean, some birds live pretty long.
And under human care, that lifespan, Roger mentioned earlier, wild bald eagles, 20, 25 years. Under human care, that could double.
Mm-hmm.
Or more. So my favorite answer is I remind them that we have close to 200 permanent residents here, and I can't remember my nieces and nephews' birthdays, let alone 200 hatch day birthdays here. So
yeah. So a lot of these birds will be the age of the kids' parents.
Absolutely could be. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Generally, the bigger they are, the longer their lifespan will be. So bald eagles living into their 40s. Mm-hmm. But a small kestrel or a screech owl, if they live into their teens, they've lived a good life.
So the kids, they'll ask how old they are and can they touch them? And the answer to can they touch them, what's that?
No, I mean, okay. We have very specific permits for all of our native birds here, for whether they're used for education as ambassadors, whether all the birds that come in through the hospital are held under a rehab permit, and breeding birds are under a breeding permit. So it's all regulated through the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. And that means that they are not pets. It's a hands-off thing. These are birds that, if they're in public, it's used to have an education message. And it just, it would be stressful for the birds anyway. They may sit close to us. They may sit on our glove as trained birds. That doesn't mean they like affection or attention. Birds of prey are typically kind of standoffish, even amongst themselves in the wild. So that carries over. And if you touch them sometimes, or put your hands near them, they're like, what? They find
it's
that
not
offensive.
A Disney movie.
Yeah, and besides, if they don't like it and they feel threatened or scared and they put their foot out, which is how they're going to defend themselves, they can cause serious injury. That's how they make a living. So you have to be very careful.
This is also one of those I think has been misrepresented on social media. People have, in some countries, you do allow like pet owls or things like that, and you have ones that are imprinted, and so you see videos of them being touched, but that is not going to be most owls. They don't want to be touched. So for their trainers here have built a relationship with them based on, mutual trust and respect for each other, and the birds know that we're not going to be touching them just for the sake of it. And then you'll also see videos sometimes of sick or injured birds being touched in these social media videos where people are like petting the bird and going, oh, it's soothing. And what that actually is a stress response. So if you have a sick owl and you're petting it on the head and it looks, it's kind of closing its eyes and like laying down, it's not actually being soothed. It's being stressed, and it's going into shock, essentially.
Yeah, it thinks it's about to be eaten.
It thinks it's about to be eaten, and it's just like, maybe if I just close my eyes and die, I'll be okay.
Yeah. One of the most important concepts of leave no trace is respect wildlife. Don't feed them, don't pet them. And a lot of people have trouble believing that or understanding that because they see people on social media scratching, trying to get a selfie with a bear and other stupid things. So most important, I mean, the most common questions for the kids is, can I pet them? And how old is it? So what are the parents asking?
One of the most common questions on our social media from adults is it a boy or a girl? And it doesn't matter if it's one of our rehab patients that we're posting a story about or one of our ambassador birds that we're posting about. People want to know, is it a boy or a girl? And this is also one of the hardest things for us to actually determine. Very few raptor species are sexually dimorphic, so most of them have the same plumage for both males and females. And with most raptor species, there is a size difference, with females generally being like 10 to 20% larger. But there is also an overlap range for most species. So the general answer is, we don't know. So sometimes we'll spout one out, like we'll have used he or she or something, because we've made an estimate based on size. But unless we actually send out a blood test for DNA testing, that's all it is an estimate. But that's one of the most common questions on our social media platforms. It will be asked on pretty much every single post we make.
Okay, so let's say you're at the pub with your friends and everybody's talking about work. What do you want to tell them about your work? Eileen, you want to go start? And if you don't go to a pub, that's okay. Let's say you're at a restaurant or something.
I can use that example just fine.
Can we go now?
That happens.
I know
when,
that's why I asked.
When we sit down in our friend groups, you know, tell me about the birds, and you know, they want me to show them pictures. And I think one thing that still is just incredible for me to see and witness is the different behaviors that I see from these birds. They could change on a daily basis, on a minute basis. But I love to see their behaviors. What are they doing? How are they reacting? What's the temperature like? Is that affecting them? So I really get a kick out of just seeing their personalities and their behaviors come out. And I have learned so much about so many different birds from around the world from being here. One of my favorite species is a white-tailed eagle. I didn't know what that was 4 years ago, but it's an incredible bird. And I get very excited and enthusiastic about that. And I just start talking birds and where they live and what they eat and what they're doing here. And what do you mean they have an injury? And you know, and you just start, and then it doesn't stop.
Yeah. And that's why I asked this question. You know, when I hang around with my accountant friends, nobody asks them about taxes. But I'm pretty sure that everybody wants to know what you guys have going on. So, Roger, what about you? What do you like to talk about bird-wise when you're...
Lately, I really like to talk about the conservation plans that we have, because we're really wanting to get back to helping endangered species. When I started here in the 1980s, we were working big time with barn owls, because at that point they were the most endangered owl species in Missouri and in the Midwest. Now that I'm here 36 years later, barn owls are nesting in every county in the state of Missouri.
Yeah.
Largely because of the work we did.
These success stories. It's such a good, warm, fuzzy feeling.
And then
feeling.
The bald eagle was endangered when I started and when Eileen was young. And now they're not. And a lot of that's because of the work we did and the message that we shared. So now we have to kind of live up to our name and talk about and help birds from other parts of the world. So we're working with the Vietnam pheasant, a bird that's basically thought to be extinct in the wild, that has a very small natural range. So once the Vietnam War took place, it didn't have much chance when its habitat was totally destroyed. Well, the habitat's back, but the birds aren't yet. So that's a species that we're gonna help with. We're working with Vulpro in South Africa, because so many vultures on that continent are critically endangered. So this is a newer phase of our work in conservation. And that's kind of one of the things that I'd like to talk about as far as us making a difference.
Sure.
A lot of my friends are going to be fellow rehabbers or in the kind of vet tech world. So we're usually talking about the cool cases we currently have. So if we have a more unusual injury, we'll be talking about that or something weird that we saw. We'll also be talking a lot about the treatments we're currently trying. Rehabilitation's at a really cool point, I think, in the field. because back when Walt started World Bird Sanctuary, wildlife rehabilitation was a pretty new field. It was these people who were starting to find more injured animals and were wanting to do something about it and finding that they didn't have anywhere to take them. So people started rehabilitation centers, a lot of them out of their houses or out of a trailer or out of whatever space they could find, their basement, whatever it might be, and just trying to do the best they could for the animals. So a lot of rehabilitation facilities, even like the oldest ones, mostly only date back to the 70s or 80s. And so now we're getting to the point where there's rehabilitation centers in enough places that most people have a place to take injured animals now. And there's still places that are that have to drive a ways to get to one. But that network is improving, and the network amongst rehabbers is also improving. And the documentation of things we've done and tried and the information out there is available. So it's no longer just people who are trying to do their best to figure out what they can do to help these animals. There's now these couple decades of data of what's worked and hasn't worked and studies on how we can do better. So we're at a really cool point where we can actually use the data from other facilities and find out what our facility can do better. And they can use our data and find out what their facility can do better. So that's a lot of what I'm usually talking about with people is, oh, here's, you know, this cool treatment thing that we're trying. It's like, oh, well, maybe we'll have to try that with this bird. Here's this one that's not progressing the way we'd like. And this, you know, this part isn't working and we're having a hard time getting this. And that's always just really cool to be able to network and discuss and see how much the science has grown. And I'm really looking forward to like the next 5 to 10 years as we continue to kind of push what we can do to be able to increase our success rate and get more of these animals back to the wild.
Yeah, you know, I think a lot of people don't fully appreciate the level of professionalism you guys have. And they think that they can find a bird on the side of the road and they could treat it just fine at home. That's not the case. You know, it's tough work. It takes training. It takes science.
If you find an injured animal, get it to a rehabber as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. The number of cases that we end up not being able to help because someone kept it for too long is really heartbreaking, because people will find something and it'll be, you know, on the side of the road. And so they'll have taken it home and they'll give it chicken or something for a period, hot dogs, American cheese, birthday cake. The number of things people try and feed is just outrageous in some cases. But they'll have had it for like a week, and then they'll be like, well, I've had it for a week and it still can't fly. Yeah. And it's like, it was hit by a car. Like, it needs actual medical attention. It doesn't need just food and water. It needs actual medical attention. So then they'll bring it here, and well, we'll find a fracture, but the bone is sticking through the skin. And so it's a fracture we could have repaired if they brought it to us when they found it. But because the bone's now been exposed, the bone is dead. It's no longer a fracture we can repair. So people don't often realize that they need more specialized care. And I think people just, they want to help, but they don't really know what to do. And there are still people out there who don't know that there's places to take it to. But we always kind of compare it to if you were hit by a car and you were picked up by the ambulance, do you want them to hand you a ham sandwich? Because that's always people's first instinct is, well, I fed it. And it's like, if you were hit by a car, would you want a ham sandwich? No, you'd probably want some pain meds. You might want some fluids. If your lungs were full of blood, you'd want some oxygen support. So if you find any injured animal, get them to a rehabber immediately.
Yeah, I like the comparison with a human injury. You know, you're not qualified to do it, probably. You need to get them to a professional. That's why I'm glad you guys are here. I know there's been times when I've found injured birds, and I tried to call someone, and like even Illinois State Parks, I found a pelican on the Illinois River. It was wrapped in fishing line, and we got it off, but it was still visibly injured. I called Illinois State Parks, and they didn't quite know what to do or who to call. I know that a lot of birds, they're not really daytime birds. They're nocturnal. How does that affect this place? I mean, some of your birds, are they pretty much?
I mean, I think one of the biggest differences is, you know, when a bird is tired, it's going to sleep. When it's not tired, it will be awake. But we do adjust feeding times with certain species. So for some of our more nocturnal feeding owls, we'll feed them later in the day, as opposed to some of our hawks and vultures will feed at the beginning of the day. So I think it's just a species by species, depending on when they are most active, when they will have that eating pang going. So we can adjust that.
Wildlife is never also going to never sleep as deeply as humans do, so we think about our hours of uninterrupted rest that we like. If you're wildlife, you're always kind of keeping like part of your brain out for potential threats. So they're never sleeping as deeply as we do. So even for the owls that are maybe getting disturbed by us for treatments or for programs, they would be disturbed in the wild by blue jays bothering them or squirrels running by. So they're kind of like waking up periodically and then sleeping. So they're not, it's going to kind of be the same thing here. They're going to sleep when they're in between activities.
Yeah. I guess you can adjust the lights also on some of them to keep them in their preferred place.
All of our buildings will kind of have a normal like day night cycle, lights on during the day, lights off at night. So even if they're being housed inside like a rehab patient is, they'll have that kind of natural day night cycle.
Mm-hmm. So you guys were just talking about like Perry was mentioning about a bird being entangled in fishing line. I know we talked about this before the podcast started, but what would you guys recommend to do with fishing line?
I would say, well, you were mentioning, Ron, that yeah, it's hard to make it go away. Even if it goes in a landfill, it's going there. Could you burn it? Yes. I don't know if that also releases, you know, toxins, burning plastic. I would say another thing would maybe be to cut it into smaller pieces that wouldn't make such a big tangle, which, you know, that might be a pain in the neck. But if you reduce the hazard that way, you don't have this really long piece of fishing line that just can weave its way through and tangle up legs and wings. That would be a way, but before you dispose of it. I don't know. Any other ideas?
Yeah, it's really hard when you have something that doesn't biodegrade and is such an entanglement risk, because you do have animals that will be scavenging at the landfill, like you say. So it will be there still as a hazard. So I would agree with chopping it up. Or if you have something that you can kind of bag it and conceal it in, because it's just then in something that isn't as much of an entanglement risk. And plastics are certainly one of those issues we're going to have to deal with, and we haven't necessarily figured out the best ways to do that. So between chopping it up, it's still going to be plastic that's there.
I'm glad you guys brought that up, because I carry Victorinox multi. I carry several Victorinox with scissors on them, because a lot of times what I'll do is I'll wrap that fishing line up around three fingers, and then I'll cut it in three spots. So that way the line is only about that long. And I don't think that that can entangle a bird, but I'm not 100% positive. So I normally still like putting it into a Ziploc baggie or something like that, because anything that's non-biodegradable, I disagree with. I mean, I'm drinking out of a plastic bottle here, which I know is going to be in a landfill for a long time if a person just throws it in a trash can. But back in the day when people used to bring six-pack of beers and stuff on the rivers, they would take the six-packs and throw it, just the plastic part, throw it out in the water. Well, what happens? A turtle crawls through it, and it gets tangled between the front legs and back legs. And then that turtle keeps growing, but there's a spot that's bigger on the turtle because the plastic doesn't give. So that's why I think it's so important. And you pull fishing line off of birds all the time, probably.
Yeah, it's not as big of a problem for the raptors as it is going to be for like the pelicans and the herons. I think Wildlife Rescue Center, who does the water birds locally, is probably going to see more cases than we do. But we see probably at least one a month that we're pulling out a fishing line, and it's usually the species that like to spend time near the water's edge. So our most common victim of fishing line entanglements are going to be barred owls. And the fishing line entanglements can be really devastating injuries, because either it's a fishing line that's up in a tree, so they've gotten their wing caught and then they're hanging there. That puts a lot of pressure on their joints, as well as the fishing line is cutting off circulation. It can also be really hard to reach them where they are, so it can take, you know, hours for us to be able to get them down. In some cases, we've had to rent a boat and get the boat out to the island where the bird was hanging, and then clip the fishing line and get them down and then still get them in here. So,
and it destroys feathers.
And it destroys feathers. So the last barred owl that we had with some fishing line, we did imp some feathers, which is putting basically a surrogate feather in, so that we were able to release that one. But that can cause damage to their feathers, circulation. And then you also get some where the line is like in the water, in the shallows. And so you have birds that will go fishing and dive down, and then they'll get caught while they're in the water. So you get birds sometimes that we've found that are unable to get out of the water. So they're in, you know, maybe only a couple feet, but they're then trying to swim to keep their head above their water, but their leg is wrapped in fishing line.
That's horrible. I mean, that makes me cringe just thinking about that. And I never even actually thought about, you know, the birds that you do see birds dive underwater, ducks, and I'm assuming birds of prey, they also dive.
So osprey will dive to get water. Barred owls will more hunt in like the shallows, grabbing like the small fish or crawdads or things that are in the shallows, but they can still get, yeah, tangled in that just offshore line when they're getting those. They won't really dive under the water though, like the osprey do.
Well, that's one thing that I want all the listeners to basically pay attention to is, you know, this trash, people love fishing. Everybody likes fishing. Pretty much. Maybe I heard you say something about fish smelling.
I love fishing, but osprey smell like old fish.
Old fish. Okay.
Well, it contributes a lot to the economy, but as long as it's done responsibly, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, the worst part about it is I go into these other stores and stuff and look at fishing line nowadays, and they're coming out with fishing line that's almost invisible. I mean, you can't even see it. But you can't break it either. You have to have scissors to cut it. And like I said, my wife and I and my son, we do pick up fishing line around ponds, lakes, rivers, and stuff like that. We always cut it up, but we always throw it in a Ziploc baggie too. That's something I would like everybody to think about, because, I mean, if you guys weren't here, there'd be a lot more injured birds out there just because of that. Jumping away from that subject for a second, one that you guys were talking about earlier, owls. I think you mentioned that owls were your favorite.
The barn owl.
Barn owl. Are they one of the birds that have zero sound when they fly?
Right. Owls typically fly silently because of the way their feathers are structured.
Okay.
So they sneak up on their prey. They're hunting things that often have good hearing, but they fly silently so that they don't give themselves away. They don't make a noise on approach. So the mice, the rats, the voles, they don't know what's coming.
That's
like that silent flight.
And is that something to do with their feathers, correct?
It is, yeah. The feathers are very soft on the surface. So as they are rubbing together in flight, they don't make a sound, and they have a fringe on the leading edge of their wing, and that disrupts the flow of air over the wing surface, so it doesn't make any noise.
Okay.
That's one of the things that we do with kids in schools and in the programs, is we'll have them close their eyes, we'll let the barn owl fly over them, and then we'll ask them to listen. And then the barn owl all of a sudden is magically on the other side of the gym, and they had no idea that it went right over them.
Wow.
They may have felt a little bit of air as the bird passed through it, but they don't hear a sound. And you can see the looks on their face, that they're how surprised they are and how cool they think that is.
That is cool. I mean, and I think it's cool because of the fact that being out in the country for a while and stuff like that, is that when owls do swoop down into a field or whatever, you don't hear them. But I've seen hawks, and normally, I'm not sure why, but I've seen some hawks that actually call out before they hit their prey.
Well, the owl will do that too, because that will freeze that animal in its tracks. Like, what the heck was that?
Okay.
And by the time they are done hearing it, it's over.
Yeah.
They're in the talons.
Okay. Here's one question. Again, we're going to jump away from the subject of that, but why do sparrows, I guess it's sparrows, but why do sparrows attack birds of prey? And why do birds of prey? I mean, they fly, like, well, they're...
Right.
They flare off. But these little bitty birds go after... Yeah.
Perry mentioned that a little bit earlier about the Blue Jays doing that. The Blue Jays yelling at everybody. And it's called mobbing, and it's what songbirds do to, you know, draw attention to this predator in the area. It's sort of like safety in numbers. If they can draw attention to this predator and give away its location, well, then the bird's probably going to move on and maybe hunt somewhere else. So, and they're defending their nesting territory. I was in Forest Park just a couple days ago, and there was a starling on the back of a red-tailed hawk. He actually swooped down from above, and he was riding on the back of the red-tailed hawk because he was so angry with it being there. And the red-tailed hawk was kind of screeching a little bit, and I saw it was either a starling or a blackbird, but it actually got on the back of the red-tailed hawk just to try to annoy it and scare it away. That's a little bit risky. You know, maybe that red-tailed hawk might flip over and grab it, but a lot of times they just don't want to be bothered and they'll move on. That's how strong the songbird's instinct is to protect their nesting territory and their young.
Okay. Yeah, because I was curious about that, because I've seen that around my property before, to where, like, if the Cooper hawk is flying through, all of a sudden these little bitty sparrows are just flying all around it, and the Cooper hawk's doing this, like, figure eight or getting away or whatever. Yeah.
It's the mobbing.
Yeah. And I didn't realize I didn't understand why these big birds just didn't grab these little birds and flip them.
They sometimes will. One of the coolest things I've ever seen was a red tail who had, I don't know what type of little bird, but it just kept buzzing him, trying to get him to go. And the red tail was doing his best to ignore the little bird, which is, if they're comfy in a perch, is what they'll do, because he was just perched in a tree and he was just trying to ignore it. This bird kept buzzing him. And then this red tail just reached out and grabbed him out of the air. And wow. I was like, well, that strategy didn't work for you there.
Yeah. Yeah, that's...
Let that be a message to you others.
I'm enjoying this perch, and I will eat you as well if you come over here.
Yeah. And their talons, they're strong. I mean, on all birds of prey, aren't they? I mean, they can rip the skin of any, I guess, pretty much any.
Yeah, their talons are going to be very sharp for puncturing. Grip strength is going to vary by species, with generally larger birds having stronger grips. So eagles are going to generally have strong grips. But one of the strongest per size is going to be great horned owls. They have, I believe it's quoted as over 500 pounds of pressure per square inch that they can put on with those talons. So they have a very powerful grip. Peregrine falcons, though, are going to actually have a weaker grip, because they're going to rely more on stunning their prey with their feet balled up, stunning them. And then they have a specialized beak with a notch in it called a tomial tooth, and they will use that to bite the neck and sever the spine to kill their prey. So they're relying less on gripping their prey than they are on using their beak.
Isn't the peregrine falcon a bird that they use down in St. Louis City?
Well, they live in the city.
Okay.
And that was another part of our conservation efforts in the 1980s, when the peregrine falcon was one of the other very endangered species in Missouri and nationally on our continent. But we worked breeding them at our facility, and we reintroduced them into the city as youngsters, and then they came back as adults a couple of years later. And they nested on the Anheuser-Busch Brewery. That was the first pair that had nested in Missouri in over 100 years at that point. So that helped establish them living in the cities again, which they like to do because they eat pigeons and they eat other birds in general. But in the city, they eat a lot of pigeons. So living down there in cities also mimics their wild nesting sites, which are typically in canyons. And the city is kind of an artificial canyon. So that's been well established. They're nesting on a lot of the buildings down there. We just put bands on 4 baby falcons on the top of what used to be the AT&T building. It's now under new ownership. I don't remember the name. They're nesting on that building. They've nested in a lot of buildings and even the bridges going over the Mississippi River.
And that's kind of what I heard, was they liked keeping pigeons and stuff away. And that's why I thought that they were actually introduced to St. Louis for keeping the pigeons away. But obviously it's...
Well, it was to help them come back as an endangered species, because one of the things that happened when they were reintroduced in wild spaces and canyons and cliff sites was the babies would get eaten up by predators, because baby peregrines are very yappy and very noisy, and they give their themselves away with where they are. And so they don't have those same predators on the tops of buildings. So that's why it was such a success, not just in St. Louis, but in many cities.
I guess we'll end the podcast with this question, and I want to make sure that we get all this information out to everybody that's listening, is how can people help donate to your organization financially?
Yeah.
We already talked about volunteers, but we want to talk about financially. How can people donate financially? Is there things out there that people can do that, like, I know you guys have specials, like drive-throughs or whatever. Is that correct?
We did those during COVID when we couldn't have a lot of face-to-face. We started doing drive-throughs. So that was a big part of getting through that summer, that whole year of the COVID challenges. But the first thing to do is to visit our website. There's giving opportunities on our website. We're going to be starting a giving club this summer called The Rescuers, and we'd love to have people involved in that, because people think when they come out here, oh, we're part of Lone Elk Park, or we're government funded. No, we don't get any government funding. Everything we do, we have to earn through program fees and our admission to come in here and park and see all the bird aviaries. And beyond that, we have to raise our money, and becoming a member, adopting a bird is another fundraising effort that we have. Visiting the website and going to the giving tab is a great first step. But we, at the same time, we'd love to have that, because that really helps us do the work that we do. We really want you to come visit. We want you to see what you're doing, what you're helping here at the hospital. See the aviaries of the birds that call this home permanently, and find out more about what we're going to do in conservation in the future. Come to one of our WOW shows, our World of Wings. What's the other? Amazing Animal Encounter. Yeah.
Show.
Yeah. Amazing Animal Encounter show, which we have on Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 1 o'clock. See the education team in action and see how all the facts and cool things about these birds we've been talking about. So we want you to experience all of it while you're becoming a donor too, because that's how we're going to have a future.
So do me a favor, and all the guests a favor, can you please give us your website?
Sure, it's worldbirdsanctuary.org.
Okay.
We're a 501c3 nonprofit organization, so it's a tax-deductible donation.
Fantastic. And then can you also give the address?
We're at 125 Bald Eagle Ridge Road, Valley Park, Missouri, 63088. You can call us, 636-225-4390.
Okay. Is there any like billboards out there before you get here, or is the only sign here in Lone Elk Park? I mean, that's...
Yeah, our sign is right next to this road, next to Lone Elk Park. They're our neighbor. And yes, you do have to navigate the world's most confusing interchange to get here. They reconfigured it about 7 or 8 years ago. The bottom line is you want to get to the North Outer Road westbound, and that will lead you straight out to us once you've gotten through the traffic roundabouts. But we're at the exit for Interstate 44 and State Highway 141, North Outer Road westbound.
And if you are listening from out of state and can't come visit us in person but still want to learn cool things about birds, you can follow us on any of our social media accounts. We have Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. We share stories about our ambassador animals and our rehab patients on there, so people can kind of follow along. People can also follow along with our patient care on our website. So all of our patient website records go on there, so people can actually read about the daily treatment the birds are receiving in our hospital.
Fantastic. And we do have listeners all over the world. So we have listeners, the majority. I mean, I'm amazed at how many people listen to us from Germany, but we got tons of listeners in Germany. But we have listeners all over. We have them throughout the United States. We have listeners on the other side of the world. So I was amazed to see how many listeners we have everywhere. So yeah, this is not just going out to St. Louis or Missouri or whatever. This is going everywhere. We try to be a podcast that basically does help out organizations, so that way people can find ways of helping organizations like yourselves. They can make a donation. I mean, this has been a real nice pleasure to be able to talk to you guys and be able to come here and see the area. I would recommend all the listeners that can come here to come by and view the area. I think, what's the administration fee to come here? Or
It's $12 per vehicle to enter. Yep. And then for those that are local, if you get a membership, you do not have to pay the admission fee.
Okay. And what is the membership cost?
There are different levels.
I think the lowest level is $79 a year. And then I think we have one for $99 and then a family plus for $199. And those come with free admission, different guest experiences, member exclusive events, and a discount at our gift shop.
There's also, is one of those memberships for the release of birds?
So people can sponsor a patient on our website. So you can just sponsor a patient, which is $35, and you can pick your species, and you get a little digital certificate with the patient's story and a photo of them. We just updated those, so now they're set up like an old-style medical chart with like a clipped photo. They're pretty cute. Or you can sponsor and release a patient. That's $150. All the releases are local. But that lets you get an invite to the release, so you get to attend one of the releases of one of our patients ready to go back to the wild.
That's awesome. And is there anything else we can talk about that can help you guys out financially or voluntarily?
Well, just coming out, visiting, becoming a donor at whatever level you're comfortable with, coming here to get to know us, I think that's really all about it.
Fantastic. And I didn't even know about the memberships until you guys just brought that up. So that's another thing that people need to check into, is becoming a member. So other than that, I want to thank all you guys for your time. I really appreciate it. And I hope all the listeners enjoy this and are educated enough to follow through with helping out. So
yeah, any questions? info@worldbirdsanctuary.org.
Fantastic. Well, thank you all for listening, and thank you guys for being here, all the guests, and thank you for having us. Thank you guys. Have a good one.
Thanks, Ron.